Hey, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of the A1 Auto Body Podcast with me, your host, Nick Sands. Today, I am talking with Todd Stogwell, the owner of Island Concepts, also known as Island Custom Concepts on Instagram. How are you doing today, Todd?
I'm doing good. I just got to make a correction. I don't own the company. I only work and operate there.
Oh, I apologize.
It's okay, you know. I've had multiple titles there. Let's just say they had me as a technical director to where I think I must have got lowered in my pay grade, and now I'm technical manager. I haven't figured that part out. They keep paying me more.
Well, that's all that matters, right?
Yeah, right.
So what
it's actually however my business card comes back when my boss orders me new ones. It's either I get a bump in a title or I get demoted. I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out.
Sorry about that. I thought that you owned it. That's my bad.
Oh, it's fine.
So what exactly do you guys do over there?
So we are a small jobber here in the state of Hawaii. We're exclusive sales rights for Axel Nobel. We were BSF, but we went single line now. We supply about 35 shops here in the state of Hawaii. So I'm on the main island, and then I have two other islands that I travel to back and forth multiple times a year and service their shops.
That must be kind of cool that you get to do a little bit of traveling but kind of stay in the same area.
Oh, yeah, totally. And people that follow me on Instagram, I kind of show them where I'm going, and they can see, like, because I get to stay at the resort, right, and then go to the shop all day. It's not like I go to the beach and have Mai Tais on the beach, but I'm at a shop. But I come back, and I show them sunsets, the morning sunrise, you know, give them a little bit of taste.
It's absolutely beautiful out there. Did you grow up in Hawaii?
So the background, I was born in Redding, California, back in 1970. So I feel like I'm a fossil now. and then moved up to the North Bay with my family. And we lived up just an hour north of San Francisco in what you call Sonoma County, the wine country, which a couple of years ago almost all burnt away from the fires. So just a little bit after sixth grade, and then my parents split up and my dad moved here to Hawaii, and he asked us to come here. So we came here back in 81 or so. And then I stayed here until 91 and then went back to California to live for 20 years. And now I came back in 2011 and I've been here since.
That's awesome. So you've been traveling around pretty much your whole life. Well, maybe you've been spending long stretches in different places your whole life then.
Yeah, it's almost that if I looked at it, the balance point is that as much as I lived in Hawaii is as much as I lived in California. But it was cool because I did all my high school. I did my, you know, junior high school and all that and left when I was about 21. From Hawaii, and then, you know, went over there, and that's where I got into auto body there, and then came back here with it.
What's it like living on, like, a relatively small, compared to, like, California? What's it like living on maybe a group of islands instead of as part of, like, the mainland?
Well, let's just say it's like this. As you're living here, you got to face things like flash flooding, which you saw that I posted before, that driving through roads that are, you know, succumb to a torrential downpour within an hour, and all of a sudden the roads washed out. We could have like that missile scare crisis. Everybody here was like, oh my God, we're going to die now. The bomb's coming, right?
Oh my God, that must have been terrifying.
Yeah, you know, I was really surprised that people didn't get so over panicked that they started doing a lot of stupid stuff. But there was people putting their kids down in the manhole covers as a bomb shelter, because we don't have that here. We don't have basements. So yeah, right? And it was just, everybody afterwards was like, oh my gosh, this is just crazy. And then the other thing we face is hurricanes and tidal waves, you know, tsunamis, right? So we have a lot of nature that takes us out more than anything.
And is there any kind of concern that, like, you guys won't, like, how much support are you really getting from the mainland? Or is that ever a concern that, like, for somehow you would be cut off from, like, the main?
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. Because everything is either flown in or boated in. So you got to look at that. Everything you see here in Hawaii came from somewhere else, either by a boat or by plane. So everybody was panicking about they were going to shut the ports down and then we wouldn't get supplies in, right? So everybody got stupid, bought all the toilet paper out, just wiped out all the shelves to the point where nobody had nothing and nobody could get nothing for at least 2 weeks. Because you got to understand, you deplete us, it takes 2 weeks for a ship to get here. So it's like, everybody's like, well, I guess I can't wipe my butt for 2 weeks, so what are we going to do now, right?
Well, you live next to the ocean. You can just go out there, right?
Yeah, right. And there's showers, too, right? I mean, that's the nice thing about here is that if you can go outside and take a shower with the hose, and you're fine. Back where you're at in the wintertime and you take a shower with the hose, you're probably frozen, right?
Well, what's funny is we had the same kind of shortages and stuff you guys were facing, except we didn't really have an excuse because we don't have to worry about that. We don't have to worry about not being able to get a ship in for 2 weeks.
Yeah. So and we probably had different items off the shelf that you lost, you know, were cleaned out and were depleted here. So everything that was depleted here was rice, Spam, Vienna sausage, all these other things that you would never even think in the mainland that, you know, you would be consuming mountains of. But here they were gone.
It is funny because probably the things that were left the most in stores were like canned meats, because nobody around here eats canned meats except for tuna and like corned beef hash, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Canned meat is big, right? You got, like you said, Spam. You guys eat a lot of Spam. You eat a lot of like Vienna sausages and stuff.
Yeah, a lot of people do. And it's, you know, it's like this because people ask me, why do they do that? And so growing up here, a lot of families, you know, it's expensive. And unless you got a good trade, you're not going to make good money. And so therefore, a lot of the families all live together. They call it Ohana living, where there'll be a house, two-story house, but a whole family would be down below and a whole family would be up above. And they all just make huge, big meals, right? I mean, big things that are popular here at plate lunches is like beef stew, chicken curry. You have your other main dishes, but it's like whatever you're going to make a big pot of is a lot of what the abundance of food that people buy.
Oh, that's kind of cool, though, that you guys, you know, kind of live like that and you can, I mean, multi-generational living and stuff. That's always kind of cool and different compared to like over here where everybody, you know, it's like we all can't get far enough away from each other.
Yeah, well, you got to look at it. I'm on an island that's about 30-something miles wide by maybe another 20-something mile long. And the thing is we have a population over 1 million people here on Oahu. And the dense population of that is in a corridor that's probably 7 miles long by a mile and a half wide. There's probably almost 900,000 people living in that corridor.
Jeez. And that's on just the Big Island?
No, this is on Oahu, the main island. The Big Island is like 300 miles away, and let's say that island's like 300 miles in any direction.
Oh, wait, the Big Island, is this the main island?
The Big Island is, so Kona is one side. They call it the Big Island. There's Hilo, that's the other side. So it's all kind of just, it's a big mass of an island. If you took all the islands, they would all fit on the Big Island.
Okay.
But Oahu is Honolulu, Waikiki, the North Shore. So if you know where if you ever heard of Pipeline, the Pipeline North Shore is just like 10 minutes away from my house. Epic Surfing is just north of me. And Waikiki and Honolulu and all that, Diamond Head, is about an hour south of me.
Oh, that's awesome. Do you surf?
I do. Not as much. I go paddleboarding a lot more, though. I live a rock star away from the ocean. But it's nice, but the thing is so the big problem we have out here is erosion. So the ocean is basically eroding Hawaii away. And they're really taking a slow step in trying to do preventative measures. Where now they threw out big bags of rocks out in front of my house to stop the water from eroding the highway. They let it get all the way to the edge of the highway until it started falling in, and they went, oh, crap, we got to fix this. So they fixed about 6 miles of the coastline just by dropping bags of rocks, and that's their answer. And we're like, okay, this isn't going to work very long, but we'll watch it.
Great. How did you end up getting into auto body?
So I'll say, so when I was growing up here, my dad had a cabinet shop and construction, and all I was just the labor guy. When I moved back to the mainland, California is where I got into auto body. I had friends that had a shop, and they fixed cars and stuff. And I had an old 77 Celica that I wanted to get done. And they're like, well, come down here and hang out and help us out and this and that. So they helped me sand my car and prime it. And then that was it. And then, you know, I'll give you a little bit of history. You know, if you look on my Instagram, you'll see that I got a post that I'm clean and sober for 20 years.
Congratulations.
So drugs were a part of my life when I was growing up. I partied a lot. That's why I moved away from Hawaii, because the scene here was getting crazy. So I went there and found a better scene, and it was more drugs and more people to hang out with, right?
Right.
So through that, you know, I got a little bit of incarceration. But while I was incarcerated, they had an auto body program. I signed up for it. I got a certificate from that, and that was getting me through the door and back in 92 at a Ford dealership body shop. And basically, I was doing those late 80s, early 90s Ford F-150 peeler trucks. So we were stripping them down, chemical stripping or sandblasting them, and then prepping them, and then giving them to the painter, and then he would paint them. And we'd get them back, and we'd put them together. And just from there, it just started bootlegging along until about almost 2000. And then I got in the booth and was spraying a lot more. And then from there, it just took off. And then, like I said, in 2011, I came to Hawaii because 2008, the economy was tanking. And I came out here in 2010 for a trip and brought my fiance at the time. And she's like, oh, my God, we need to move here. So I said, well, you know, it's nice. There's options here. Went back to California, and my boss goes, well, you know, while you're gone for 2 weeks, I could still run my business and I won't need you. And we went from 14 guys on the floor down to 4 when I left. And when I came back, there was only 2 guys in the shop, another painter and a body guy. That's how bad the shop became from the economy then. So I told my wife, well, I'll write unemployment and we'll start figuring out. And, you know, in a year's time, we moved there.
That's a big move probably because you got to figure out how to get all your stuff across the ocean.
Yeah, I'll just tell you. So we had 2 garage sales. I had enough crap that I accumulated over in California. I made $80,000 to pay for the trip. So I sold a car, a beater bike, but just a lot of odds and ends stuff. But the thing is we loaded up an 8x20-foot container with our household stuff. I mean, I broke down as much stuff as I could. And then we shipped an 03 Buick, and I had an 85 K5 Blazer Cherry. Redid the motor, did everything, because I said, whatever I'm going to do to this truck, I need to do it now, because I ain't going to find anything over there. It's going to be rusted out or disintegrated. So we shipped it over, and this is where we've been since.
I feel like living in Hawaii, you're going to run into, you know, a lot of people are going to need body services, body and paint services, because obviously the ocean's right there. It's eating everything up. On the other side, you guys must just have, you know, less cars than most places, you know?
Parts are harder to get.
There's probably, I would think, less, you know, kind of cars being sold and stuff. What's the car culture like over there?
So it's totally opposite than what you think. So if you look at like sales history here, there's over 55,000 new cars sold every year. And we don't even think that even half of those cars are leaving the islands. They're just being resold out. The rental cars are being resold out here. Just to give you an example, let's say there's 6,000 people that live in Kauai, but there's 20,000 tourists that come and visit. So there's more people in a rental car and staying in a hotel than there is actually people on their island. So it's kind of funny. And the same thing here is that, you know, they say in the island there's almost 100,000 people coming in and going out in a day. So there's a lot of movement. And with cars on the road, everybody's got to drive to somewhere. And before this whole virus pandemic happened, there was not enough body shops to fix all the cars that were damaged in the state of Hawaii. So
wow.
There was like a 2-month surplus of schedules that all the shops have. So now all the big shops that have been running off their schedule, they've depleted those cars to the point now where they have no more inventory of wrecked cars. And it's the vicious cycle, which I know everybody's dealing with across the United States, is that nobody's on the road to smash their cars. And so that's the same thing that we're at.
That's really surprising about the amount of cars there are, but it makes sense too that there would be a lot of accidents because there's a lot of people driving unfamiliar cars.
Yeah. No, totally. And the other thing, so somebody told me this, I don't know how true it is, but they said there's more cars here than can fit on the roadways. So if you pulled everybody's car off their property and put it on the road, there wouldn't be enough room for all the cars. And people like their cars out here. I mean, it's a big scene. There's everything from imports, Chevys, you know, four-wheel drives, Toyota trucks, to there's a big bike scene. I'm in a bike club out here. You wouldn't believe there's probably 20 to 30 different bike clubs running around out here.
Really?
Yeah, and the culture here is just like how it is in the mainland. Everybody loves everything that's going on, right? You have the biggest melting pot of the world right here. Different nationalities, all your Asians. You have people. You have the big Puerto Rican base. We have a lot of people from the different Polynesian islands, the U.S., overseas, Brazil. You name it. All those people are here. It's just a big pot of different types of culture.
And you guys must be constantly getting injected with new culture too, because like you said, there's so many tourists from all over the world. I mean, I think when most people think of like a tropical vacation, they think of Hawaii, you know, it's kind of like the vacation to take, you know?
Yeah. It's just like going to Vegas, right? That's the epic center of being in a casino. You know, you want to strike it rich. And out here, it's like, you know, maybe people think that, you know, this is where they're going to fall in love and this is paradise, you know, until they get sticker shocked at how expensive everything is. And then they just want to go home.
What's it like living in that kind of all the time? Because you do. So I know that everything out there is much more expensive than it is on the mainland, and has that caused it any problems in the past between like tourists and like residents?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So people come out here and they get the island fever and they're like, oh my God, this is beautiful. I'm going to come back here. They go back, they do whatever they need to do to settle their affairs. And then they come out here and then they go, oh man, now I got to try and figure out. Okay. I'll just give you a prime example. We were those people. My wife said, look, we can come back out here. We can move and do all this stuff. So I said, you know what? We can. I says, you know, there's jobs here. I've seen all this. So, and I'll just give you a brief history. Like, you know, I said, you know, I don't talk much with my family, and this is I can explain the situation when we came here. My dad said, hey, you know, once you guys come out here, you can stay with us. It'd be a great place for you guys to shack up and stuff until you get your feet on the ground. So we're like, cool, yeah, it's not a problem. So over a year period of time, I was kind of rekindling a relationship with my dad that kind of fell away from the wayside before I left. And when we, you know, came time to move, he was like, yeah, you know, I'm kind of getting in a little bit of problem right now. And, you know, he lived up on the biggest house on the baddest part of the island that you could live on, of being the rich of the rich. And we thought he was well off. And then he started singing me the story that he's not doing well. So I gave him some money so he can borrow. We still moved out here. Within the first week, we found out that basically he wasn't paying his mortgage on this 52,000 square foot house that's worth like $10 million. yeah, right? It's this story of like, what? What do you mean? What? And my wife-to-be is looking at me like, are you serious? What did we just get into? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. And so he's going and he's like, I got to go talk to my attorney and I'll be back. And we're like, okay. He comes back and he goes, hey, I just got to tell you, we got to move out at the end of the week. And I'm like, what? My stuff is on a boat traveling here. My wife's car got here already. So we had her car and we're like, oh crap, what are we going to do? And he's like, well, I need you to help me move my stuff out and put it in storage. And we're like, well, what are we going to do for a house? He's like, well, we'll go and we'll find a place. And I said, okay. And then he starts saying, well, you know, he had a nice car. He had a nice brand new Range Rover. He had a truck. And he's like, we'll dress up. We'll act like we got money and we'll get into a place. And so we went and looked at a house to rent for $4,200. And I'm like, I don't have a job. I mean, I got some money in my pocket, but I don't have a job. And my dad doesn't have any money. So what are we doing here? And he's like, well, we'll just say that you make $120,000 and you own a shop somewhere. And I'm like, dude, that ain't happening.
This is how we got in this position in the first place.
Right. And then I started figuring out my dad was a hustler, right? He was out here hustling money from people. He was doing a development project and he was getting money from people and he was living off of it, part of it. And so long story short, within the first week, we were homeless. He went and stayed with their friends. And then me and my wife, and I had my son at the time, and we're like, what are we going to do? So we tried to go find an apartment and everybody wouldn't rent to us. And this is the vicious cycle that I was saying. People come here thinking that, oh, I'll just move here and blah, blah, blah. We went through probably 30 different interviews trying to get an apartment and nobody would give us a break. Well, you don't have any references. You don't have a job and this and that. And I was like, oh my gosh. So we went and stayed on the beach one night. I said, hey, we'll go stay on the beach in Kailua where I grew up at. It's cool. I did it plenty of times. You know, we'd party on the beach and just sleep on a Hobie cat, right?
Yeah.
We get over there. We bought a nice comforter and stuff from Target and went down to the beach and it was chilling. It poured rain that night. We were sopping wet. My wife was like, oh my God, I just want to go home. And I'm like, oh, this is crazy. So I said, okay, tonight we'll stay in a hotel. And so we did that. And I mean, every day I was going to, there's a mall. I was going to the Apple store and I was on one computer looking for work. She was on another computer looking for apartments. And we'd get a list and we'd start tracking down and see what we can do during the day, right? And long story short, I called one job. I think it was the second job I called. And the guy says, come down for an interview. I came down in 10 minutes. He says, you're hired. He says, when can you start? I says, well, this is my situation. I have nowhere to live, and I'm waiting for my stuff to get off the boat. He's like, get your orders and fare and come back. So that afternoon, we went over and seen this little Japanese lady at this small little apartment. And the lady's like, are you okay with this? And I said, absolutely. I says, I will give you 6 months of rent in advance and sign whatever you need to sign. And that was our gateway. And if you look at it today, that was 2011. In 2014, we bought our own house 3 doors away from the beach. So, I mean, we're living the dream.
That's an awesome story. And I think it's pretty cool the way that you guys, I think it would have been really easy for you guys to give up then and just turn around, just say, you know, screw this and just go back to the mainland. Or, you know, it would have been really easy to just kind of give up. And instead of doing that, you doubled down and you just worked harder. until you made it work. And I think that's a really awesome story.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's a lot of just, you know, reaching into your inner self. I mean, my wife was struggling with it. And I was like, I was on the hinge of swinging this all around. I says, well, we got enough money. We can just put the container back on the boat, ship our cars back and tuck our tails and try to figure out something in California. There was nothing to go back to though. And, you know, and it's again, it's a moment of hitting rock bottom in your life and what you can do on the other side of that and how you persevere from it. And that's what we did.
That's really cool. And now you're doing it now, look at you.
Yeah, right. And it's a lot what I try to instill into others, you know. It's a part of my job is also dealing with people's, you know, feelings and emotions, you know, because I work with the painters and also got to work with the shop owners. So I have both sides of the pendulum I have to work. I have to work with the guy that doesn't like his boss, and I got to work with the boss that might not like his employee or thinks that his employee needs to work harder. And how do you mend that bridge or get them to understand what the primary goal is here on both sides of the fence?
One thing I wanted to talk about that I think is pretty cool is your guys' logo is like an awesome tiki head.
So the tiki is mine. So our logo, we've changed it. It used to look like kind of a chemical symbol. And then we went to the island chain, but the tiki is mine that I've hand painted. So that's a big thing that, you know, we can talk more about, but I know you have a lot of questions and I want to run through your questions. I mean, I can deep dive and stuff all day with you.
Yeah, absolutely. No, deep dive. I would love to hear the story about how you came up with the design for that tiki, because it's awesome.
So the thing out here, when we came out here to visit in 2010, we drove by this little place up in Kahuku. It's about 10 minutes
Kahuku?
Away from my house, Kahuku. it's well known for the shrimp truck. So when you come here, everybody's got to go there and get the shrimp. The plate lunch shrimp, right? And they have prawns that grow out in the fields, right? They have these big ponds, and everybody stops there, gets a garlic shrimp, whatever. Well, just down the road from him is a guy that carves tikis out of monkey pod wood. So if you ever, when you get off the phone with me, you Google monkey pod wood. It is the most amazing wood. So the inner core of the wood is dark, and the outer live edge of the wood is white or a light beige color. So the older the tree, the darker the inner part of it is. And, I mean, you can make some phenomenal stuff. And the guys that know what they're doing with the tikis, they can carve out and integrate the outer core of that lightness with the inner core of the darkness with their design. On my Instagram, if you deep dive down in it, you'll see that there's a few of the tikis that I bought from him at my house. I've sanded them and re-cleared them. And if the wood is nice, I just re-clear it. I even made myself a wood table. So I even have that posted if anybody wants to look at that. I mean, and I went straight to the sawmill and bought the wood from the guy, sanded it, put it all together, and clear-coated it. I probably use about 6 gallons of clear, but don't tell my boss, to clear it all in. And I sanded it, cleared it like 6 times. Anyway, so with the tikis, I just started kind of just, it became an addiction. And so anytime I'll comb Craigslist trying to find them, but the ones that are nice, I'll refurbish them or restore them and then clear them with automotive clear. And it just preserves it, makes them look a lot better, last longer than varnish. But the ones that are, the wood's not in good shape, I hand paint them. And I use automotive paint. And I just use a brush and paint them up, and I'll either matte clear them or gloss clear them. And that tiki was, somebody brought it to me, a kid that lived down the street knew that I liked it. He was like, dude, I got a couple of tikis, and one was this little one, and he looked like an alien. And I was like, I'm going to paint him green, and that's going to be my guy. And so from there, it was like, everybody's like, cool. And I wasn't into Instagram then. And then all of a sudden, they're like, dude, you got to start posting your stuff. I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, get an Instagram account, put this stuff on it. And I was like, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, and this and that. And it's funny because, you know, a lot of stuff, there's, you know, Dave that's in Seattle, in Washington area, that he paints the RVs and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, we were messaging back and forth, and I was like, because my original name was Boo Boo Foo. and I told him, I got to get serious about this, I think. And he's like, you know, why don't you come up with a name? And we're just, you know, we just kind of went back and forth, you know, direct messaging each other. And then all of a sudden, he came up with something, and I came up with something, and he said something about the tikis, and I said, yeah, and this and that. And then I said, well, I'm going to incorporate my work name, custom, and then it just kicked off. And it's been a blessing. I really like Instagram. It's really excelled a lot of stuff for me and exposed me to a lot more information and a lot more friendships and, you know, social networking.
Oh, yeah, it's a blast. I love it. it's very cool to be able to reach out to people. I always say that, like, you know, before, because I worked in a shop for like 13 years, or I've worked in my family shop now for 13 years, 14 years. And, you know, before this whole Instagram thing, you know, I maybe met like 10 other people who had worked in auto body, and then maybe like one or two who had worked on trucks, you know, but it wasn't really much. But now I can just type it into Instagram. I can meet, you know, thousands of people who do this for a living. It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. And I noticed.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and I noticed that, you know, it doesn't matter what you do. It's just once you start creating, you know, and people are interested in stuff, or you're interested in them, I mean, you get there's just a huge following of all different kinds of stuff that, you know, you can really meet a lot of different other people that are involved with it, and which is great, especially with the refinishing side. You know, it's just crazy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that social media as a whole has just pushed, you know, the level of like art so far in the last 10 years, because everybody's seeing what everybody else is doing, drawing from everybody else. I feel like just the art that's being put out today is so far beyond what anybody was doing 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, totally. And I agree with that. I mean, it's like, you know, I found paint huffers and all this stuff, and I thought that was all a lost art, right? I mean, a lot of the guys that I knew that were pinstriping were old timers, and they were on their way out. And then all of a sudden now it's like, oh, there's just a whole new era of people. And I'm like, wow. And the abilities of what they're doing, I'm just like, you know, when it comes to custom work, I'm like the little dim light blinking on the bottom of the Christmas tree, as everybody else I see on Instagram is the big, bright, shiny star on the top. And I go, man, I'll never get there.
No, nah, man, that's not true. You're a big, bright, shiny star, too.
Hey, we all shine in different ways. That's all I can say.
What was it that drew? What is it about the tikis that draws you to them? The way
you
does?
Know, I think it's, there's a lot of spiritual belief behind them. They're protectors. They have a lot of, you know, they're like demigods, right? So there's a lot of background behind it, and especially living here in Hawaii. There's a lot of folk tales, which you would say, but we call them Hawaiian legends. And there's a lot of cool stuff that goes in and around the tiki. They have a lot of spiritual stuff. So I use them. For me, they're more of a protector, right? They fight off evil spirits. They fight off evil energy. Plus, you know, it's just, I don't know. I think they look cool as hell.
They look cool. Yeah, exactly. Do you feel as though you've, like, kind of fully integrated into the Hawaiian culture, and that you are just kind of, like, do you consider yourself a Hawaiian now?
I wouldn't say so. There's that whole racial part of it. The thing is I would say I'm a local white guy in Hawaii.
I should say, and I don't know much about, like, Hawaii or anything about anything,
you know,
to do with Hawaii. So I'm not really, I'm just kind of, you know, if I offended anybody, that wasn't my plan.
No, not at all. So, you know, and this, it's funny that you said that, because I was talking to this, you know, this Hawaiian guy. He lives across the street from us in this brand new apartment building. And he sees all the stuff that I'm doing. So he's always coming over. He's like, hey, brother, what do you got going on today? And we just, you know, we just talk normal, you know, just down to earth. And we were talking about things yesterday about, you know, how people are out here. So we have protesting, right? And it's the white people protesting. And all the locals are like, what are you doing? You know, and it's out here, it's more of a respect thing. And you respect the culture, you respect the people, and, you know, you put out good energy, you're going to get good energy back. You go out there and you be disrespectful and put bad energy out there, you're going to have your ass handed to you quick. And you, if you don't get kicked off, if you don't get kicked off the island, you'll be floating face down off the island some way, somehow. I mean, they'll teach you quick. But, you know, like I said, I grew up here. I went to school. I never had any problems. I get along with everybody. It's a big family atmosphere. Like I said, if you're cool and you don't have, you know, an ego or that, you know, you're some hothead, let me tell you, the people here are open arms and willing to help you 100%. And that's what I like. And that's what I try to project out, you know. Especially when I talk to other people that I don't even know, you know, it's just treat the people the way that you want to be treated.
That's beautiful, man.
Yeah.
It's a nice, it must be just a nice, nice vibe over there, you know, especially because
yeah.
I feel like because there are so many tourists, that it must bring everybody who lives there kind of closer together, you know?
Yeah, totally. And you know, the big thing is you go to somebody's house, they tell you, come in here, you know, eat food, do this, do that. And when you're done at the end of the party, people make you take home food so that you can feed your family later. That's a part of how, you know, the tradition is here. It's all about love, respect, and helping out each other. But, you know, at the same time, there's a lot of people out here that'll rob you blind, too, you know. It's a mixed plate. You know, I'm not going to say it's a perfect world everywhere you go, but, you know, there is a lot of good here.
Going back around, so what exactly is your day-to-day look like at your job?
I actually
thought that you were just a painter all the time. I didn't realize that you were also a jobber.
Yeah, so, and like I said, I do tech support. I'm also part of sales. Also, I mean, right now my guy is off this week our warehouse manager, so I was covering that. So my day-to-day job is we do a lot of inventory, going to shops. We do product management, everything from, you know, we do lean training. You know, we do a lot of skill-based training. We do, I do tech support to everything that I do, shop analysis. We deal with everything from the financial benchmarking of the shop, how to grow their profits, to everything from sales, putting paint, you know, selling them paint, training the guys how to use the system. I've gone as far as going to New York and got fuser training. You know, somebody told me about trying to be an iCar trainer. I don't know if I want to go down that road. But I'm just trying to expand more knowledge that I can expand to my customers. So my day-to-day is everything from doing inventory, coming in, seeing what they need, placing orders, to doing color matching, to doing, you know, troubleshooting. It's, you know, my phone calls range from everything you wouldn't believe. You know, and I tell everybody, there's no dumb question. I can only give you a dumb answer. You know, and the fact that, you know what, if you're questioning something, it's just that you have doubt, and I'd rather give you confidence. So you let me know what it is that you need. And, you know, a lot of the time, it's just people just need to have reassurance that, yeah, that I am doing it right, or that, you know, what do you think? You know, I just get a secondary opinion, which I find is good because they validate my word and my opinions. And I appreciate that with my customers.
Yeah, that's awesome. And how many shops do you work with out there?
We're about 35 different shops. We have everything from big big running shops down to guys that are just spraying out of their, you know, out of the back of the house to, you know, they just have a 2 or 3 car stall shop. You know, and they're just, it's just one man operations. And you know, a lot of the stuff here is a local vibe. So like over there, everybody's shop is all closed up. There's a lot of shops with a lot of open air, right? Because you need air to breathe in and out of the buildings, so it's not hot in the summer, it's hot in the winter too. But the environment's more open. You just got to be protected from the rain, right? That's the main thing. So it's a different animal being out here. But the thing is you got to look at is the climate is so predictable. Other than you have a lot of humidity, it's going to be warm. You don't have to deal with those cold winters where you're pulling a car out of the cold weather and then it just sits in your car and condensates. We don't have that problem here. The car, you know, you have about a 70 degree temperature is about the lowest it gets. And let's say about 95 is the highest. But an average you're running every day is about 85, 87 degrees. So that's just where you stream all of your product at and you train all your technicians at that temperature level. And it's pretty much flawless.
So whenever I hear about like temperatures like that, I always think it sounds so nice, but in honesty, I'm fat and I get overheated really easily. So as nice as that sounds, the truth is I would probably be there just sweating to death all the time.
You're probably what we call a 2 or 3 shirt guy, because that's how many shirts you would go through.
Oh, easily.
Because you'd just be, slopping wet. Because the humidity is the part that gets you. You come here and you're just like, you get off the plane, you're like, whoo, I'm already sweating.
Sometimes and I then walk you gotta... upstairs too fast and I start sweating. And that's New Hampshire.
Yeah, right?
Although it must make things, like you said, a lot more streamlined, because that's one less thing you kind of have to put in the equation, you know?
Yeah, you can take like I have shops that are on water base and solvent. So, you know, we have both lines running. The thing is in solvent line, no, we don't even sell fast. It's too quick. It's not even worth it. You know, medium is fast, slow is medium, and extra slow is slow. I mean, that's how we have to operate. You know, it's, and a lot of, like, if you don't have there's a lot of shops that don't have baking units. They don't have heaters in them. And there's the bigger shops do, because they're trying to, you know, ramp out the production. But a lot of the guys, you know, I would probably say 40% of my shops don't have heat.
No heat at all?
No heat at all.
Oh, yeah, no, I guess heat. You wouldn't need it, huh?
You wouldn't need it. And, you know, and you use like, you know, these air bake clears where they just naturally like the air flowing and it helps them, right? They stay wet and, you know, pliable, and then all of a sudden, you know, the clear locks up and then it starts hardening out. I mean, I got clears that I don't even have to bake and I can paint a bumper, clear a bumper, and a half hour later, I can literally mount it on the car and get it out of there.
Wow.
You know, and if you want, you just throw it out in the sun and then you got God's heater. I mean, you know, and UV is really killer out here too. That's a big thing that's taken off is the UV primer. And the shops that use it, you know, I got guys that want to try and prime a whole car, and I'm still not telling them, you know, I tell them, don't do it. It's just too much for that. But, you know, bigger things, you know, they'll prime it. They'll just wheel it out in the sun and boom, kicks off. But we don't recommend that. But do they do it? Yeah.
Yeah, just because it's not on the bottle doesn't mean you're not going to do it, right?
Yeah, well, you know, we recommend it, you know, you use the UV light, you correct it right, you know, because the light penetrates a little bit better than the sun. But the thing is, the guys will just let it sit out there and leave it.
Right. Sun's cheap.
Sun is cheap, right? And the thing is, the guy goes, well, I don't want to stand there and hold the light, right? So I'm going, okay. I can't tell you to do that, but what you do after I leave is what you do, right? And, you know, so again, you know, part of my job is regulating the crew.
I just thought about this, but how cold does it get? Sorry, obviously I don't leave New England much. I'm fascinated by the fact that it stays 70 there all the time.
So the coldest?
What about at night? Does it get colder at night?
Okay, so where I live, I'm right at ocean level. So if you climb up, there's, you know, you got to go over the mountain through tunnels to get over to the other side of the island, or you physically got to drive along the shoreline around the rest of the island to get over to the other side. But as you climb up the mountain, you can change about 10 degrees. The coldest I've seen it here was 54 degrees, and that was probably, I don't know, maybe a 2,000 foot elevation. But when I go to the Big Island, it snows on the summit. So, and that's 14,000 feet up.
Okay, that makes sense. So the higher you go, the colder it's going to get.
Yeah, but for I'm going to say 99% of the land mass will never see snow and will never get above or get below 50 degrees. But the other percentage, that's the peaks, like on Maui, they have a laboratory up there with a telescope. Same thing on the Big Island. Those up there, there's such high elevations that basically it'll snow up there. It'll have its own climate, its own, you know, winter wonderland. And they'll tell us on the news, hey, it snowed up there. I've seen it once when I flew over to Big Island to my customer's shop. I was like, oh, wow, I can see the top of the mountain. Because it's so high up, usually there's a cloud base that's covering it all year round. So unless there's certain times of the year, the wind's blowing it away.
That's actually one of my bucket list items is to go and up on the observatory up there.
Oh yeah, you definitely. I would go to the one at Maui. I don't know about the Big Island one because you know we got all the protests and stuff. You know, you got to get through the people up there. There's a barrier, but Maui, there's I think it's clear passes, and you can actually coast a bike all the way down the road. And I heard it's crazy.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, as long as I don't have to pedal up, right? I'd rather just go downhill.
Yeah, I'll probably walk it up. Or maybe I'll drive it up and coast it down.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Are there any, like very stringent natural, like, protection laws there or anything that, like, maybe people on the mainland don't have to think about that you do because you're on an island and everything is very contained little ecosystem over there?
You know, you would think, I'll just tell you this, there's the rules of, like, having so relaxed here. I mean, we do dispose properly, but you want to know the way that people dispose of oil here when you change your oil?
Sure.
So you go to the auto parts store and you say, I need an oil change box. You're probably going, what the hell is that? That's a box with a bunch of shredded paper in it, but a bag. You go underneath your car, you take the drain bolt out, and you let it all drain into this box with the bag with the shredded paper. Put the bag up, put it on it, close the box up, and what do you do with it? Just guess.
Throw it in the garbage? Dump it in
you
the ocean?
Throw it in the trash.
Dump it in the ocean.
No, jump in it. Yeah, that's what I'm just like. No, you throw it in the trash. And so what they do is they take all the trash to the H plant and they burn it. So they say it fuels the.
Oh, you actually just broke out there for a second.
But no, we do handle stuff and have it. Rules out here.
You're actually breaking up a little bit here.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I'm just letting you know. So you said they take it to the H factory. What's that?
H plant. So that's it's the power company. They have a big incinerator. So what they do is they burn trash to make power.
That's awesome.
Right. Yeah.
How much trash
on some part,
produce?
And then.
Todd, unfortunately, you're breaking up. I'm going to, hello? Hey, Todd, sorry I lost you there.
Oh, no, it's fine. We're back.
We're back.
You know,
hey, it's...
like I say, it's the coconut wireless out here. You know, it's you got to cross the, you know, the bamboo, and you know, and hopefully wave the tea leaves, and you know, and the menahunis let you get back into your connection.
Get the professor over there and to fix up this radio.
Yeah. You got to. That's the other thing I didn't explain to you. You got to understand. I'm the latest guy in the world right now because I'm all the way. It's like everybody from me going. Like Australia, Japan, all that, they're already a day ahead of me. And you are you're 6 hours behind me, right? So I'm the latest guy that's up right now.
No, I think I'm six hours ahead of you.
Yeah, ahead of me. Yeah, I'm six hours behind. So that's what I mean. I'm so far behind everybody, right? That, you know, Australia could have news, but it's going to take 24 hours for me to be aware of it, right? Just like for you, it's going to take 6 hours for me to be aware of it. You know, I'm just one single guy out here on a rock in the middle of the Pacific.
That must be kind of a cool feeling, though. You know.
Yeah, until you got a tidal wave, and then you're like, "Oh crap, where am I going to go?"
All right, good point.
I got a kayak, so as long as I can get offshore, I'll be all right.
What are you gonna do about your cars, though? That's the real loss.
Hey, well, I guess we order new ones, right? Hey, you know that there's cargo ships with cars that sink out here, right?
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was one that was on fire and it sunk, all full of brand new Toyotas.
Gonna have to bring my Magnum out there, see if I can find anything.
There's probably a lot of stuff underneath the sea. We just don't know.
What happened? What do they do when that happens?
I don't know. I mean, if they're going to salvage or just sink, it just depends how far down it goes. Because, you know, it can get 2,000-3,000 feet underneath the water. And I don't know how you're going to pull that up.
Yeah. I'm thinking, like, if it's, you know, because I know that, like, I was talking to that Pine Ridge Chipper guy. I don't know if you've listened to the podcast, but there was a guy on him from Pine Ridge Chipper, and they like make wood chips and with these giant machines. And occasionally these giant machines will accidentally like sink into the ground because it's like this mossy like material, and it'll just like suck the machine down.
Oh, wow.
And he said you if that happens, you have no choice but that you have to get it out legally. Or you can get a huge fine for every day that it's down there. So I wonder if like, you know, Toyota loses a, you know, couple hundred cars under the waves,
there,
if they have to do anything to get it out.
I think it'd be the shipping company's responsibility. They do salvage stuff. I mean, there's like, you know, I bet they'll have some kind of documentary out there about it. But yeah, out here in Hawaii, you beach a boat on the reef, you got to get it off it. And they just kind of just let it go, and it's your responsibility. They might come out and suck all the fuel off it, but they'll just let it sit out there and let you have to get it out. And then if you don't, I know that they'll take it and they'll repossess it, and then they sell it at auction. You know, and I've seen boats that were just listed over in the harbor, and you're like, holy cow. And then they sunk. The next day you come by like, oh, it's crap, that boat's underneath. and then it's on the news, and then, you know, everybody's rallying around, and then they get the boat out, and then, the owner pays thousands of dollars in fines.
Yeah. Imagine I can't even imagine what it's like to have a giant boat and then just have it sink. Like, that just must be the worst feeling in the world, you know? Yeah. Like, being an owner of a shipping container, like, boat, and then having that sink. You know, you must have millions of dollars in the hole at the end of that. That must just be heartbreaking.
plus all the product. I mean, so we ship in all of our stuff, and I'll have two or three pallets of product, and there's over $100,000. So you can just imagine what's in a container.
Yeah.
TVs, you know, all kinds of stuff. Yeah, a boat goes over, it's going to be big bucks.
I'm curious. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, what do you think, what's like some advice you would give some people who are trying to come into this industry? I know that you've talked about, you know, coming on to try and kind of help promote the industry and stuff. What are some things that you would suggest to kids or people who want to get into it?
So for me, a lot of what I'm trying to do is I got this gal, Marlene. She works. She used to work for my competitor as a jobber, as a tech support manager. Now she's an instructor at the local community college in the body shop program. And so what we're trying to do is help build a better interest. So what we're trying to do is go to the high schools, any career fair day, anything like that. We're trying to get in there and help bring awareness and show what exposure and what's really going on in the shops. But as in just a, you know, kind of a public service announcement for somebody that's looking to come into the trade is, you know, the best thing is to find a mentor, somebody that knows something about this so that you can kind of get some background of what you're about ready to get into and somebody that's current of what's going on in the industry. And then the thing is building some fundamentals around that. But as for here in Hawaii, it's just like everywhere else. There's not an abundance of new technicians. So what we're trying to do is develop technicians out of kids off the street. I mean, we want to find kids that are savvy with their hands, have a good interest of being, you know, positive, showing up every day. You know, a lot of kids nowadays, they want to be on their phone. They want to be lazy. They don't want to come in all the time. It's like, oh, I don't feel good. I'm going home. You know, I really don't know if they know what a hard day's worth of work looks like anymore. But the thing is we're trying to, you know, gear kids up so that they can understand that, you know, if you put in the time, you're going to get an investment out of it. And we're trying to make it fun, right? I mean, if you got a kid that's just in there sanding bumpers all day, he's not going to have fun. But if you throw him a bone and start teaching them what the fundamentals of how the shop is, what your role is in the shop and how you benefit the business, is making them feel like there's an investment on their part, which is huge. And once you can have somebody to have confidence that, you know what, I'm working for a bigger picture than I'm just working for a paycheck and to go blow it off at the end of the day, you're going to have an employee for life. And so that's what we're trying to do, is really season people up, put them underneath the right people to train them. Because if you put them with a grumpy guy, the kid's going to come out just hating people. But if you put them underneath with a positive, energetic person that really inspires them, man, it's the output you get is just tremendous.
Absolutely. I think definitely the community building aspect of the business is something that a lot of times is overlooked, you know. People need to You need to like where you work. You need to like the people you work with. If you're working with, like you said, grumpy people all day, you're never going to get what you want out of that job.
Yeah, you if you work in a negative environment, and you're a positive person, it's gonna change you. It's gonna blow all that energy out of you. And then if you don't leave, I tell people, I look, you know, there's no bars on this building. You know what I mean? You're not in prison. If you're not happy here, then the thing is find what makes you happy, or how can we figure out to make you happy? And that's a lot what we do. So, you know, when I get a shop, they get a new technician, say, hey, we want you to come in and work with this guy. Everything from preppers, I even teach guys how to polish, the detailers, how to wash the cars, to dealing with the production managers. But just kind of give you a forefront with the, like right now, we're going to do a evaluation with one of my customers, and we do monthly meetings. We come in, we talk about their progress. It's basically, we have, you know, a big spreadsheet, and it just has everything that we want them to achieve, their goals, long-term, short-term. And then we go over it and we try to figure out, okay, where do we need to focus and what's going on? Are we struggling in this area, or were we accelerated in that area? And we help them farm raise technicians. And that's just a part of where a jobber has to be nowadays, is being one-on-one with their customer, with their technicians, and just, you know, help manage their business better.
Right. It's about more than just selling a product at this point.
Oh, yeah. I don't drop paint and go. There's a whole big picture behind the scenes, you know. And if that's, and I tell people, I mean, if that's what you're getting, you're missing out. There's more opportunity, and you need to start looking and apply that pressure. Your jobber has the ability to help you out. They have the resources. The paint manufacturers, you know, they do training. They have an abundance of information to help boost the shop performance and production, and as well as training for their skilled labor. It's a lot more than where it was about 15 years ago when I was really looking at this.
And also, I think the internet is turning into a huge area where people can go to at least learn if this is the kind of thing that they want to do.
YouTube certification?
Yeah, exactly.
believe me, I have guys all the time message me, hey, I've seen this, can we do this? How have you tried this type of process? And I look at everything, and if it looks good, I said, hey, let's start tomorrow. Or I take it to my boss and says, hey, I think we got something there that we can work with our shops. Or this is an answer that we saw that we weren't really getting a good result for. I mean, I'm not gonna, you know, walk away from anything. If somebody shows me something and there's some viable, you know, good pieces that I can use, oh, it's money on the table.
And like you and me were talking about, kind of before the call, the just like the ability to reach out and talk to and get help on even on something like Instagram is so massive now.
Oh yeah. Just the other or last night, a girl asked me about, you know, with the flakes and how do you do that? And what are you doing? What are you mixing? What is this? And what is that? I even went back to like paint huffers on like, I had a post that he did and I saw somebody message, hey, what are you using the flake in? What's the amount? And I just listed basically everything that I did. And I said, the tech tip, put 5% hardener into it so that you're getting a cross catalyzation to your base, to your clear, you're interlocking everything, you know. And I think that's good information that we can just post up and somebody will read that. And then it helps sell his product too. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure.
And, you know, and it's backfilling information that somebody might be wondering, but should I ask? Don't be scared. Ask. That's the big benefit nowadays. If you ask, usually you're going to get an answer.
Right. You might get a couple of snide remarks, but I think most people on the internet are there to help, you know?
You know, it's funny you say that. I mean, I had one or two people comment some stuff, but I had, I'll just say Wayne over at Damage Undone. Oh, that guy came off and went off on this guy. And I was like, whoa, man. I said, I put my big boy pants on. I can take some criticism, right? And, you know, if I look at what I did wrong, right, and I hold my value to it, I'm not perfect, and neither is everybody else. You know, I am not the perfect painter in no way, and I don't expect you to be. And the only thing I expect is you just follow the format or follow the TDS or what the rules are, and you have a roadmap to success.
Absolutely. Wayne over there is a great guy. I actually had him on my podcast too.
Yeah, I saw it. I heard it too. It was great, you know, and he's a great guy. I mean, we always, you know, message each other and talk about stuff. We're always trying to figure out ways to collaborate to, you know, kind of boost things. Yeah, he's been a huge platform for me. I can't give that guy as much credit as due as that he deserves. He's a great person.
He's a super nice guy too, because I remember he had reached out to me originally, I think, to see if I wanted to collaborate. It was just, that was the first person who had ever done that, so that really stuck with me.
Yeah, it's totally cool. I mean, we got booth talk now. We got all this other stuff. I mean, there's, like I said, there's a huge platform that, you know, you can be a part of, get information. And like I said, if you keep a cool head, people are going to keep cool with you. But I know if you're going to turn into an a-hole, you're going to get an a-hole right back. I mean, I've seen the memes out there. I mean, I don't get me wrong, I love them. But the thing is, you know, if you're going to put your foot in your mouth, you're going to eat it.
Well, Todd, I think, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Sure, sure. And hey, feel free if you want to do another one. You know, I love this conversation we had, you know, and there's a lot more topics I'd like to get into. There's scanning. There's all the high tech stuff with cars that needs to be done. You know, I mean, we can go hours and hours on other stuff. You let me know.
For sure, man. I would love to have you back on anytime. you want, you let me know and we'll get you back in here.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Todd. Have a wonderful night.
You too. Aloha, my friend.
Aloha to you too. Thanks, buddy.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening today. If you enjoyed the show with Todd, could you do me a favor and just subscribe? Or if you don't want to subscribe, could you just do me a favor and leave me a good glowing review of how much you love the show and why? If you didn't like the show, if you could just do me a favor and give me a terrible review and tell me why it is you didn't like the show, so that way I can make it better. I hope you guys have a great day, and I hope to hear from you soon.